Good afternoon and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. This week, Chris Messini welcomes back Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture Executive Director Wes Jessup. Dan Webster takes the measure of a new film, and I'll have a conversation with John Zoltek, music director of the Glacier Symphony Orchestra in Kalispell, Montana, who provide the music today. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini. My guest today is Wes Jessup, Executive Director of the Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture. The museum is now open. They have four new exhibits on display this fall, and Wes joined me to talk about those exhibits. Let's start by saying that the MAC is open. We're not talking about virtual exhibits or, otherwise ways where you're not going to be standing in close proximity to works of art, right? So tell us about reopening the MAC, because I know that happened not all that long ago.
We reopened for the last 3 weeks of Pompeii, and we're at 25% capacity. We require face masks and social distancing, and we have increased the cleaning of all the galleries and the surfaces in the whole facility. So we're making the whole space as safe as possible for everyone. And the good news is that we sold out in 3 weeks of tickets. So that was really a wonderful thing. People have to purchase tickets in advance. They need to go online, and there's a timed ticket function on the website that allows you to purchase it for whatever time of day you're planning or whatever date you're planning to come. So, and that continues on through the fall, and we will be reserving tickets that way. So that's a big change. But other than that, I think the staff and the community found that, you can still really have just a wonderful experience at the MAC. The galleries are open. You can, you just have to be a little bit more aware of your surroundings. And the new exhibition we have, Pop Power, which is a exhibition of pop art last five decades. There's just some masterpieces in this show. It's very exciting. And it's going to be a really great show for Spokane. A lot of really well-known artists, everybody from like Andy Warhol to Jeff Koons and, Keith Haring, Damien Hirst, Takashi Murakami. And they're great examples of, how these artists, well, in the case of Warhol, kind of invented the genre, and then five decades later, how artists are reinterpreting that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the sort of headlining exhibit for this fall is called Pop Power, From Warhol to Koons. And you mentioned a few of the names. Any favorite pieces that are going to be in that exhibit?
I love the classics. I love the Lichtenstein comic strip pieces. Those are just, they're impactful. All of the work, the thing I love about pop art is just, it is really direct and it's very accessible. And it's fun to see how artists interpret, media imagery, celebrities, advertisements, and kind of weave it all together into their work. And I think overall, the way that artists in the 1960s really were just kind of going against the really quote unquote serious art world and the tormented artist and the studio. I mean, they really moved away from that and they were much more lighthearted and interested in how society was absorbing all of these this barrage, you know, which at that point in time was still fairly new.
Yeah, and you mentioned the exhibit includes some of those masterpieces from the likes of Warhol and others from the 1960s, but also sort of neo-pop, you know, artists, contemporary artists. So how can we see that movement sort of change over time over the last, you know, 50 years or so?
Well, you definitely see it in the way artists are producing their works. This is a show of prints. And so the collector we worked with for this show, Jordan Schnitzer, has the largest collection of prints in the United States, based in Portland, over 13,000 pieces in his collection. And he loans pieces out to museums for exhibitions like the one we're having. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things is that you see different, you know, there's differences in scale. There's differences in kind of how pop has transcended, has moved around the world, it's international. So, you know, some of the most famous names, Damien Hirst is one from England, Takashi Murakami's from Japan, and they kind of have their own, you know, take from their corners of the world in kind of how do we absorb this imagery and make art from it. And so there's like a strong influence of anime, you know, with Murakami. Damien Hirst has more of an English, you know, there's more of an English sensibility in some of the subject matters he has. So it's just been different. I mean, also in the 1980s, an artist like Keith Haring, who was really more of a graffiti artist, famous, you know, for his work in the subways of New York and the subway stations. And so it's very, it kind of brings back some of those earlier eras.
Speaking of returning to earlier eras, there's a couple of exhibits this fall at the MAC dealing with World War II. So there's Bomber Boys, Portraits from the Front, and American Inheritance, Unpacking World War II. What can you tell us about those two World War II exhibits?
Yeah, so we have two, they're companion shows. 2020 is the 75th anniversary of World War II ending. And we have a show from our collection where we went back and looked at objects and documents in our archive and, you know, things from our collection that helped to tell the story of World War II as it impacted the inland Northwest. So the exhibition really explores some of that through the objects and materials that we have. And it's a great commemorative exhibition. World War II, there's not very many veterans left from that war. But it's still very much, you know, it's popular culture and so I think it's a really great way to memorialize it and to memorialize people in our community who contributed to the war effort. Bomber Boys is a connected but separate exhibition featuring photographs that were discovered in the late 1990s on the west side of the state, photographs that an airman had kept. He was in a squadron with, I don't know, 15 or 20 guys that were mostly from this area. They were based in Italy, and they ran missions up into Eastern Europe. And there were a lot of photographs that he had that nobody knew about. And he kind of, like a lot of veterans, you know, they kind of just move that stuff to the side. They move on with their life, and they're not always excited to go back and revisit some of that. And so his daughter discovered these in a barn and happened to be a museum professional and, you know, organized this exhibition. It's a stunning exhibition. I mean, the photographs are amazing. They're as well as some of the memorabilia. It's a really fascinating story that talks about, you know, the drama of what it was like. But, you know, everyday people caught up in these events that had major significance. And I think that's one of the themes as you read about these men and how they had to step up. And it's pretty moving. It really gets into, you know, this idea of sacrifices people made. So I think people will appreciate the photographs and some of the other materials that we have from that collection. And it's just a great, it's an interesting time, I think, to commemorate another kind of international worldwide event that was like cataclysmic. World War II was, you know, it impacted everybody. And we're kind of living through one of those right now.
Well, Wes Jessup is the executive director of the Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture. They have four exhibits open this fall, Pop Power from Warhol to Koons, American Inheritance Unpacking World War II, Bomber Boys Portraits from the Front, and Music Finds a Way, the Spokane Symphony. Advance purchase of tickets is required due to COVID-19 precautions. You can find those tickets online at northwestmuseum.org. Wes, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Well, thanks for calling. It was great to connect.
Most of the news we've brought you about the state of concert music in the time of COVID has covered a disappointing range from dire to mildly hopeful. Today, for a change, some good and truly hopeful news from Montana's Flathead Valley. We had the pleasure early this week of hosting the Glacier Symphony Orchestra's music director, John Zoltek, who told of an actual in-person performance by the orchestra just last weekend. Here's more. We've been talking with music directors, conductors along the way about what COVID-19 has meant for their seasons. And in many cases, it's just an absolute disaster and a complete lack of the ability to make music in front of an audience. But Glacier Symphony is one of the fortunate ones. Glacier Symphony has been able to actually launch their 2020-2021 season. John, how did you do that?
Well, it's really great to be here, and it's a great question. We're actually quite pleased by the idea that we can go ahead and make music for our audiences. The past few months have been tricky trying to kind of negotiate and make decisions on what we would be doing. And just to go back a little bit, we started out our whole COVID-19 experience with the cancellation of a grand performance of the Missa Solemnis in April. We were all very much looking forward to that, of course, being a touchstone for the Beethoven 250th anniversary year. And we had to cancel that show. So that was unfortunate. Many, many were disappointed, including myself, obviously. And then, of course, we had to then consider canceling our summer concerts, which we do a significant Pops concert, which is very well attended. It's a kind of a cornerstone of our season. And of course, Festival Amadeus. All of this was completely planned and we canceled out. I had to make some decisions as to what I would recommend to our organization. And what I thought would be best is that we basically go small. So I came up with this concept of the season called Microcosms, and it's essentially a full season, which started this past weekend with our first concert, Classical EQ. It's a full season with the chamber orchestra, essentially less than 30 players per concert, which basically means, obviously, the music has to fit what we can do with a much truncated, minimized string orchestra. Usually we would have an orchestra of 60 to 70 musicians on stage, maybe 72 once in a while, but now we're doing less than 30. It was kind of difficult because obviously the entire season was all pre-planned. All our artists were booked. All the venues were booked. Essentially, I had to redo the entire season, and that's what I did, and we're off to a good start, thankfully.
In terms of audience, what kind of limitations are there for you?
Good question. Everything that we do, we have to run through the health department in Kalispell. We've decided that we were essentially put all of our performances in one venue, which is the Flathead High School Performance Hall. And normally, the seating capacity is 700. We are limited to roughly 150 people per concert, and that's based on, you know, the regulations of social distancing. So that's a factor. The live audience people have to wear masks. And we do not sell any tickets at the door. All tickets have to be reserved ahead of time, and we have to know everybody who's in the hall, not only the musicians, but the audience as well, in case of any unfortunate breakout or transference of the virus.
And how was that experience for your first concert?
It was a little weird, but, you know, it was okay. So we do double. So we do a Saturday night show and a Sunday afternoon show. Sunday afternoon is traditionally better attended. There's, people just like to come on Sunday afternoons, but Saturday night was good. But the audiences were small, and they were very spread out. So it was very, very unusual in that way. So you obviously, you don't get that massive audience reaction. But everyone was so happy to be there. It was It was really heartwarming to come out on the stage, greet people, make a few remarks about the music, and people were just ready for it. You know, they wanted to hear live music, and so many of our audience people came up to me and others on our staff and said, thank you for going through with this. We realize it's hard, but they don't want to lose that experience if we can provide it for them.
I'm curious as to whether there was a development of audience response through the concert. I mean, they, of course, are spread out throughout the auditorium. And I would think that at least initially, reactions would tend to be a little muted because it's like singing in church when you've got this congregation that's spread out all over the place and you feel like you're doing a solo. If you started applauding vigorously, you might feel at first at least that you are doing this applause solo in that situation. Did you find anything like that, or did people adapt quickly?
I think people adapted quickly, and in my experience, they kind of overcompensated for it, and they were okay with that. But it's an interesting phenomenon that we are all experiencing, not only the audience, but the musicians on stage. So instead of having a first violin section of 12 players sitting very close together, sharing a stand, we have four first violins, all separated by 6 feet, all turning their own pages, so one to a stand. That in itself necessitates kind of a mind shift for the string players because they're not used to that. So they're experiencing performing as all soloists. They're no longer really part of a section. Well, they are technically, but it doesn't feel like that to them. And So those dynamics are in play, and also the wind players are separated. But I think that that creates a certain new dynamic. So it's definitely more like playing in a chamber ensemble.
Mm-hmm. Albeit the fact that there is the distance to contend with, which
Exactly. Actually
this may turn out to be one of those blessings deep in disguise, because it does really call on all the instincts of the individual musicians to respond to that, even though they are not typically close to their neighbor players. You had to do some precautions, especially in terms of the wind players on stage, didn't you?
Right. The wind players have plexiglass in front of each performer, and all the string players are wearing masks, and I'm wearing a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Our pianist for this concert, Rodolfo Leone, an Italian pianist who came up from L.A., he's living down there. He's been living there for a number of years now. It was okay. He didn't perform with a mask on, but he walked through the orchestra with a mask on because technically we as performers, as long as we adhere to the social distancing requirements and are away from the audience, we are able to perform without masks on, but we chose not to. We chose to use the masks primarily for basic camaraderie with the audience because the audience needed to do it. We felt like we had to do it, at least the string section and the conductor.
Right, right. Very successful opening to your season. The next concert comes around when?
It's pretty quick. It's in a week or so. It's October 10th and 11th.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's on the bill for that?
We are doing a Stravinsky Pulcinella Suite.
Nice.
Wagner's Siegfried Idol. The Finiawski D minor violin concerto with the wonderful Polish-born violinist Kinga Augustine. And also we're performing Beethoven's first romance for violin and orchestra.
That sounds like a great program. And it'll be so nice to have Kinga back in the area, because I know I first met her when she came to Festival Amadeus several years ago and
Yes. Played.
And so very impressive player and a really wonderful individual. Well, John, thanks so much for sharing these ideas with us and sharing your experiences. And I do hope that the initial success of your season opener is something that you can build on throughout the year.
Well, thank you very much. We're hoping to do that as well.
From that first classical EQ concert at Flathead High School in Kalispell, Montana, a minuet from the Symphony No. 103 of Joseph Haydn. You can hear more from John Zoltek and the Glacier Symphony here on KPBX next Monday evening at 7 on our new program, Music That Matters. This is Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Don't forget that we have podcasts of these programs available from our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. The Apple TV movie Greyhound is a thrilling throwback to war films of the past, says Dan Webster in this review.
Just as former newscaster Tom Brokaw labeled those who lived through World War II as the greatest generation, that global conflict itself has come to be known as the last good war. As Time magazine's Bruce W. Nealon wrote in 1998, not that any war is good, not that there weren't terrible sacrifices, but World War II was a war that had to be fought and won. This was an unambiguous struggle between good and evil. This attitude makes things easy, or at least easier, for those among us who tend to view the world as an up-down, in-out, black-and-white binary exercise. The view of the conflict that racked the world between the years 1939 and 1945 as the last good war offers the simplest answers to a particularly horrible era of history. Representative of this view, many of the movies that captured that time, even the great ones, such as William Wyler's aptly if ironically titled 1946 film The Best Years of Our Lives, were, by and large, similarly simplistic in theme and tone. Though there have been exceptions, especially in recent years, changing attitudes and the efforts of filmmakers such as Oliver Stone and Francis Ford Coppola led to war films made during the Vietnam era tackling far more complicated scenarios. Which is why the Apple original movie, Greyhound, feels as if it's from another earlier and far more innocent time. Based on a screenplay written by the actor Tom Hanks, adapted from C.S. Forrester's 1955 novel, The Good Shepherd, Greyhound is a rousing study of the courage shown by the crew of the USS Keeling, a destroyer with the call sign Greyhound that is tasked with protecting a 37-ship Allied convoy bearing supplies bound for Great Britain. Directed by Aaron Schneider, Greyhound is streaming through the Apple TV subscription service. The movie's time frame is the winter of 1942. Hanks plays the Keeling's captain, a veteran naval officer named Ernest Krauss. Though he is on his first wartime mission, Krauss is the senior officer of the four ships escorting the convoy. It is he, then, who must take charge when word comes that a German U-boat, and ultimately a whole wolf pack, is preparing to attack once the ships entered the Black Pit, that part of the Atlantic crossing in which the ships will have no air cover for nearly three full days. Other than a couple of short scenes that show Krauss meeting with the woman he loves, played as the obligatory symbol that the movie considers her to be by Elizabeth Shue, the movie gives us basically no backstory on Krauss. What we learn about him comes through the few scenes in which he is shown quietly but devoutly praying, from the quick thinking he shows in adapting to the tactics of the German submariners, from his willingness to admit his mistakes and learn from his errors, and from the dedication to duty that shows through long hours of neglecting food and, visual clue, dealing with his blistered and bloody feet. What director Schneider spends most of his efforts on is portraying action, with Krauss haunting the destroyer's decks, his every move attracting the stares of his youthful, clearly frightened crew, and all of it accompanied by the pulse-pounding musical score of composer Blake Neely. Showing just how far CGI has advanced in recent years, most of the action comes rendered courtesy of actors standing in front of green screens and aided by a whole gang of computer-literate workers sitting in front of glowing monitors. This is the case whether we're talking about exploding depth charges, oil slicks spreading across the water to mark undersea death, torpedoes scraping the sides of their targets, the distant blossom of ships on fire at night, or, most impressive, an ascending view from seaborne terror up through the clouds to capture the wondrous sight of the Aurora Borealis. Those computer graphics are certainly more effective than the film's acting. For his part, two-time Oscar winner Hanks is required to do little more than grimace continually, eyes squinted and lips pursed, as Krauss ponders the loneliness of his first command. Shue is basically window dressing, which is another aspect of Greyhound that fits with old-school war films. Yet as Krauss's executive officer, British actor Stephen Graham is everything he needs to be, as is German actor Thomas Kretschmann, who, though unseen, provides the sinister voice of the submarine commander Grey Wolf, who taunts Krauss over the radio. In the end, Greyhound works best as a tribute to those who fought in World War II, a mission it acknowledges during one of the few pauses between the movie's otherwise near-constant action, a burial-at-sea ceremony. Even in this far more cynical age, reverence for those who died doing their duty is the best honor we can bestow upon the so-called last good war. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 is heard Friday evenings at 6:30 on KPBX and Saturday afternoons at 1 on KSFC. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. We had help today from Chris Messini, also Wes Jessup, John Zoltek, and Dan Webster. A bit more Mozart from the Glacier Symphony takes us out. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.